Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Modern love essays explore universal questions, but they can also be products of particular moments in our culture. A snapshot in time. Dominic Zarrillo's essay about his son was published in 2012, but it feels very much like it's of a different time. It reveals how far we have come and how powerful a father's love can be. Here's Bobby Cannavale reading Dominic's piece, A Father, a Son, and a Fighting Chance.
When my son Jeff was little, he was a pain in the neck about eating. On one drive to Huntsville, Alabama, he sobbed for 70 minutes, I know because I timed it, about how we were starving him to death. We stopped at a diner and ordered him a meal, and he proceeded to eat about 4 bites before claiming he was full. You might think I would lose my temper, but this had happened before, so I was prepared with a well-planned response. I reached over and started eating his food. Bite by bite, I finished everything on his plate, figuring that would teach him to mind his dinner. Unfortunately, the plan had a different effect. Everywhere we went after that, Jeff expected me to finish his meals. It got so I would only order him meals I liked, knowing how it would go. And at home, forget about it. I was a workaholic back then. 2 jobs, out of the house at dawn, and not back until 8 or 9. A lot of those nights, Jeff wouldn't eat his dinner. His mother would get so angry, but what could she do? How do you force someone to eat? The best she could do was the tried and true route, telling him that if he didn't eat dinner, he wouldn't get dessert. I would walk into his room when I got home, and he would be lying there, wishing he had eaten dinner, so he could have a snack before bed. You hungry? I would whisper. And he would nod, big eyes gleaming in the light from the hall. I would sneak him something, our little secret. Sometimes we would eat it together. When Jeff was in middle school, my wife noticed he was getting home late from school, sometimes a little dusted up. It turned out some neighborhood boys were picking on him, waiting for him along the path they all took, making his life miserable. It made me furious, probably because I felt guilty for working so much and not being around to protect him. People didn't make a big deal out of bullying back then the way they do now, but I had to do something. Jeff was a small, sweet child who never hurt anyone. He just wanted to take the path home and feel safe doing it, but these kids kept singling him out. I went to see the ringleader's father. He was a big man in town, a city planner. When I got there, he made me stand out on the porch as if I were trying to sell him something. I told him the story, and he looked agitated and said, "When I was young, this never would have happened. We had some pride. We fought our own battles." I told him a one-on-one fight would be fine, but it wasn't one-on-one. His son was fronting a gang of bullies, taking away my son's right to come home happy and safe. 5 against 1, I asked him. Is that something to be proud of? He grumbled and shut the door in my face. When I was young, my uncle said to me, "You're small and you're Italian, so it's going to be tough. You can either blend in or fight. Trust me, it's better to blend." The first time I walked onto a Navy ship at 17 years old and 130 pounds, someone yelled out, "Another WAP?" I smiled and said, "Yup," and kept smiling no matter what else they said. My uncle was right. I got along fine. I told Jeff that story and asked him to get along the best he could. After Jeff finished college, we would travel cross-country from New Jersey to visit him in California. A few times we would run into his best friend, Paul, whom we liked a lot. Jeff would fly to visit us, too, and when I would take him back to the airport, I would sit with him until his flight boarded, just the two of us. Every time I could tell there was something he wasn't saying, something knotted in his belly. Finally, he sat us down and said he had something to tell us. We told him that we already knew, and that we really liked Paul, and that we were happy for him. We laughed about how scared he had been to tell us. And after that, it was Jeff and Paul, Paul and Jeff. We visited them, they visited us. We took vacations together. A couple of times, the subject of grandchildren came up, and they always said the same thing. They wanted to marry first, and they wanted it to be legal. Jeff wanted a family, a home, like the one he grew up in, and part of that was being married like his parents. My wife and I went to dinner one night with another couple, some people we knew pretty well, and the subject of Jeff and Paul came up. The guy said, "I don't believe in gay marriage. I think it's wrong." That's all he said, but I almost lost my mind. I wanted to smash my dinner plate in his face. My vision dimmed while long-buried emotions rushed back. My little son, all alone, being picked on by bullies, being told he couldn't walk the same path home because they said so. Why couldn't people just treat him with respect? I'm sure this guy isn't a bad person, and no one would consider him a creep or a bully, but I stood up and left that table and have not spoken to him since. For our next trip with Jeff and Paul, we went to Hawaii. The boys talked my wife and me into taking a long boat ride in a little rubber dinghy. I was dubious from the start, and rightly so. The weather turned ugly, and the waves got huge, 3 times higher than the boat. We all thought we were going to capsize. I held my wife's hand, drawing on the strength of our love and our years together, knowing no matter what happened, it would be okay, because we were together. Across the boat, I saw Jeff holding Paul's hand in exactly the same way. That night at dinner, we laughed and drank too much and toasted our narrow escape. At one point, Jeff's face was pure happiness as he looked at Paul sitting next to him. Paul wasn't returning the look, though. His eyes were focused downward to where he was quietly, carefully finishing Jeff's dinner. I realized then that I was crying instead of laughing. I couldn't explain it except to say there is nothing more overwhelming than seeing your child experience true love. Not every day will be that happy. Paul and Jeff want to marry and have a family, yet they know there will be more bullying, more ganging up against them in their effort to seek that. There will be more groups of people telling Jeff that he shouldn't be allowed to marry the person he loves, that it would be wrong for the two of them to have a family together. One of the worst days in my son's life was in November 2008, when a majority of Californians voted in favor of Proposition 8, a ballot measure to change California law in a way that bans marriage for same-sex couples. None of us could believe something like that would pass in California. When it did, I wondered if Jeff and Paul would move from the place they loved and had called home for so long. They didn't, though. Nor did they accept the new law and try to blend in, as I told Jeff to do all those years ago. Instead, they did something that's made me as proud as I've ever been. They fought back. Jeff and Paul and 2 women challenged the law in court, and in a landmark decision 2 years later, they won. Proposition 8 was declared unconstitutional by a judge in San Francisco. The proponents of Proposition 8 appealed, and Jeff and Paul won that too. The United States Court of Appeals recently declined to take up the case before a larger panel, which opened the door for it to head to the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Jeff and Paul still can't legally marry. I want my son to experience the joys of being a father. I want him to marry the person he loves and raise a family. For now, he is still waiting and fighting. I see how much the struggle costs him. How discouraging it is that, despite his strength and patience and faith in the system, the ultimate decision rests in the hands of those who have yet to act. One day soon, though, the powers that be are going to do the right thing. One day soon, they're going to let my brave, beautiful boy walk the same path we all get to take home.
Bobby Cannavale. You can see him in the movie Jumanji and the hit TV show Mr. Robot. How have things changed for Dominic and Jeff and Paul? More after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Dominic's Modern Love essay was published in June of 2012. A year later, on June 26, 2013, the Supreme Court's decision on Proposition 8 cleared the way for gay marriage in California. Dominic was in court with Jeff that day, and when the decision came down, Paul proposed to Jeff live on network television on the steps of the Supreme Court building.
So today is a good day. It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
Here's Dominic Zarrillo.
And they were kissing each other and they were crying and tears coming down my eyes. You know, it was a special moment. They wanted to make it right. They wanted to make it legal, so Jeff wouldn't have to worry about introducing Paul as my friend or my significant other, and it was joy. And my wife and I both said the same thing. It was just to see them happy was the main thing. What they wanted in life, they finally got.
Dominic is 72 now, and in his lifetime, he says he's watched a huge shift in the way different generations think about gay marriage.
My father, you would never sway him. He had passed away, so he never knew. So that generation, really, you're never going to change them. And as far as now, my grandkids, oh my God, they love Jeff and Paul. They don't even say, why do you even bother with this kind of stuff? Why do you have to go through all this here? I say, well, because not everybody thinks like you do.
Dominic spent 23 years working in the tire industry in New Jersey. He's retired and says that now he sometimes gets calls from parents who are struggling to accept their gay children. Recently, he talked to a couple whose son had just come out to them.
I say, it's the same person. It's not, they don't change. They don't change. What's the difference? That there isn't any. I mean, it's the same person you loved before. So he told you that. Now you're not going to love him anymore? He's 17 years, you loved him. Now you're not going to love him anymore? He's done? No, not that. I'm gonna love him. Okay, so accept what he wants in life.
That's Dominic Zarrillo. He lives in New Jersey with his wife. After the break, Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, and more from Bobby Cannavale.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Dan Jones says that when he reads this piece, he's moved by Dominic's strong sense of what is right.
It's such an emotional essay, in part because the father, you know, is so plain-spoken about his sense of outrage about how his son is being treated, his sense of justice and equality that his son shouldn't have any fewer opportunities than anybody else. He really just lays out his emotions. And when you realize that his son is behind the lawsuit that wound its way all to the Supreme Court, I don't know, this story really, I think it changed the world.
And Bobby Cannavale says that this piece made him want to be more courageous and open as a parent.
I was really just moved by how this father expressed his love and his admiration for his son. That just moved me so much. And it taught me a really good lesson. It just taught me that, you know, it sort of helped me to realize that I could share that more, share things more with my son, feelings about how I feel about him, how proud of him I am. It just made me want to be a better dad, you know. I just think this guy is exceptional.
Next week on Modern Love, Kate Winslet.
But in the weeks after I learned that the breast cancer I have been in treatment for over the past year had spread to my bones, breaking my spine and becoming incurable and most likely fatal, finding the perfect living room couch has begun to feel like the most important thing I've ever done.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Additional sound design and scoring by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.